Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, and welcome to another episode we have here of Suspense Radio. Look at that. We are on remote location out here in the city of New Orleans, Louisiana for this show. And in the first 5 seconds, the music decides, I'm not going to play. Isn't that just hilarious? Let's hope that that's the only hiccups that we have here. I want to welcome you. I'm your host, John Robb, and we have a very exciting show for you, 90 Minutes. We're going to kick it off with author Stephen Maitland Lewis, followed by Jeff Ayers, and then D.P. Lyle. So it's going to be a great, exciting show here for 90 minutes again, on location in the Big Easy, New Orleans. So sit back, relax, and enjoy wherever, however, and whenever you're listening. We're still going to be here because 90 Minutes of Suspense Radio starts right now. Everybody, we want to welcome you again, and we are going to welcome our first guest onto the show. He is author Stephen Maitland Lewis, author of the book Botticelli's Bastard. So, Stephen, thank you so much for coming on today. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thank you for having me on the show, and I hope you're having a wonderful time in New Orleans.
Right now, it's pretty hot, pretty humid, pretty sticky, but that's exactly what you expect here at the end of August, beginning of September down here. But we kind of talked a little off the air, which is kind of funny. I'm staying in a hotel very close to where you live, even though right now you're in the city where I live. So we just kind of switched the places a little bit, which was actually a little bit on the funny side. So
it is
cool.
Very coincidental.
So the book Botticelli's Bastard here has just come out for you. And you have... You know, you're kind of taking the reader back here into the 16th century, many kinds of things that you've woven together. Why don't you give us a little behind-the-scenes look into your book?
Well, basically, it is about the life of a restorer, an old master restorer who comes from a long line of Italian old master restorers, and he's based in their studio in London. They have a branch in London as well as in Florence. And he is working on a painting, which is a 16th century Italian portrait, unsigned. And he's working on this, and it's come to him through a nefarious route, which is part of the plot. And the restorer is going through a pretty lonely time. His young wife is out on the toot. And he's miserable and lonely, and he's distressed about the breakdown of that marriage. His son is in Florence and is very busy in his own life. And there he is, caught up in his own solitude and misery, looking at a painting which is unsigned. And suddenly he hears a voice, and he thinks he's going crazy. He runs out of the his workshop. And he doesn't know whether he's hearing a voice, whether someone's broken in, or he's hallucinating. In any event, the voice is that of the portrait. The portrait is talking to him. And as crazy as that may sound, you know, Oscar Wilde wrote a painting, wrote about a painting, the picture of Dorian Gray, and the painting aged. Well, my painting speaks. And my painting tells the restorer that he is a member of the famous, renowned aristocratic de' Medici family, and that he was painted by the greatest, one of the greatest painters of all time, Sandro Botticelli. And the restorer just doesn't believe the whole thing. He doesn't believe he's hearing a voice. He doesn't believe the painting in front of him is a Botticelli, which would be worth scores of millions of dollars. So he thinks he's going nuts. But the painting starts to tell the restorer, whose name is Giovanni, his life story, and that he was painted in 1500 and something, that he was owned at one time by Mary, Queen of Scots. Then he went to France, and he was at Versailles, and he was hanging in a room where Casanova was at it. And then he went from France. He was there during the French Revolution. He went back to Italy. Then he went to Russia, was there in the Russian Revolution. And from then, from the Russian Revolution, he ended up in Paris. And he stayed in Paris until such time as the Nazis occupied France in 1940. So the painting has a history that straddles close to 450 years. And the certain things that the painting tells the restorer start to add up and make sense. And the restorer thinks, well, maybe he should get the painting properly authenticated to see whether, in fact, it is a Botticelli or not. The difference is, if it's a Botticelli, it's worth countless millions, and if it isn't, it's worth practically nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So,
the funny thing about the art world, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. And there's so many clever forgers that there are around now and have been in history, that it's a very, very precarious situation to authenticate a painting where the difference in value can be billions, well, millions between whether it is or it isn't real. Anyway, he goes to try and find out whether there is a survivor in the family who might have owned the painting. The painting is authenticated as a Botticelli, and he remarkably finds a person living in poverty in New York who is actually the sole heir of the family that is last known to have owned it. And he now has this moral dilemma. Should he sell the painting in the open market, that's the devil on one shoulder, or should he hand the painting over to these woman in Hell's Kitchen, New York. And that's the good angel talking to him. Meanwhile, his young wife, who is back on the scene, and his sons basically say, sell the painting. And he's getting phone calls. He's fielding phone calls all the time from museums around the world that want to buy the painting. So he has this real, real dilemma. What's he going to do with the painting? So that's my story. And, you know, it's about a painting. It could equally have been about a piece of furniture that's handed down from generation to generation. I chose to do it about a painting because a painting can't be altered. A piece of jewelry, a very valuable diamond necklace or a tiara, which might have been fashionable in 16th, 17th century, 18th century, you know, a clever jeweler can extract the jewels, the stones, and make 20 rings or 10 pairs of earrings, and it could disappear forever. But a painting is a painting. So
right.
That's my book.
And what you've done here is that you brought in so many historical European elements. You've also brought in, of course, just many different aspects of the past. You've used art here as your base. Did you have to go and study a lot about the history of art, the certain things? I mean, the research that could have been involved in a book like this could have taken years. How was that background about to bring about Botticelli's Bastard?
Well, basically, the research fell into two categories. One, the historical research, and I chose things like the periods like the French Revolution, the Russian Revolution, and the Nazi occupation in 1940 of France. And that was, you know, relatively easy to do because my book is not like 1,000 pages. It's a 300-page book, give or take. So I didn't have to go into too much detail. What I had to ensure is that what I wrote was accurate, but that research wasn't too tricky. The old master painting side of the book, which of course is basic to the book. At one time, I was married to a major dealer in old master paintings in Europe, so by osmosis, I picked up quite a bit. Got a lot of aggravation as well thrown in to the situation, but osmosis, I got information about the old master art market. And I have some friends who are in that line, and a couple of museum curators. So I was able to get good assistance for that part of the book.
And I want to remind everybody here that we are speaking with author Stephen Maitland Lewis. You can go to maitland-lewis.com, maitland-lewis.com for more information here of the book that we're talking about, Botticelli's Bastard. So let's talk a little bit about Giovanni Fabrizi here, you know, the main character. He's haunted by the painting, but just like you had said before, there's also some past that he has to deal with. So why was Giovanni the one that you decided to be the main character to push the book? What pushed you to him exactly to be the head lead in your book here?
Well, you've got the painting that is on panel that's sitting on an easel. The painting can't go anywhere. The painting, we don't know, can't have feelings per se. But Giovanni, the restorer who came across this painting, he's recently widowed. He remarried very quickly to a young wife. The guy has feelings. The guy has a life. So I think it was important to bring him in and also to place upon his shoulders the responsibility of learning about the painting, having the painting authenticated, and then having this incredible dilemma and the pressures exerted from outsiders as to what to do with the painting. So... And he was also the third or fourth or even fifth generation restorer in his family. So he wanted to ensure that whatever he did, either the restoration of a painting or decisions he made, would preserve the integrity and image and overall reputation of the family business that had been going on for 100 plus years. A business that was restoring paintings for the greatest museums, collectors, the royal families throughout the world. So he was very conscious of his position in the art world. But of course he was very distressed when he found out that his young wife was having an affair. And he was immersed in this relationship with the painting. And at first I thought, you know, this is a little bit bizarre, but... Well, of course it's bizarre. I can't deny it's bizarre. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, an actor who has studied under the Method School, there comes a point in time when he doesn't know whether he's the character he's playing or whether he's an actor. He's so immersed in the role. And, in fact, one of my first novels, Hero on Three Continents, which was a fictional biography of an Englishman born in 1900 who was assassinated in 1979, Hero on Three Continents. I swear that by the time I finished the book and it had been through two or three rounds of edits, I didn't know whether I was me or I was the main character. You get so involved and so immersed. And Giovanni Fabrizi, the restorer, has done the same thing. I don't think it's unusual.
You know, and that's the one thing that I was going to ask also, because, you know, you do have, you know, three other books that you have published here, but you never went the way of a series. You kind of always went the way of the standalone. So the big debate that, of course, is going on right now, you know, you hear it throughout these conventions and people talking, is that you have the plot versus the character aspect of a novel. So which kind of the fence are you falling on? Are you kind of falling more on the plot side, or are you falling more on the character side of, I guess, how the future maybe of writing, and you're going to see more authors doing one or the other thing into the future?
You know, you've asked the most brilliant topical question, because I started a book several months ago, and I'm reasonably into it. And it is extremely, extremely strong in character. Unfortunately, I have to put it on the back burner for a while, because although it's strong in character, it's a little bit weak in plot. And I'm putting that book temporarily on the back burner to start another project. There are some writers who are brilliant at character and plot, but by and large, commercial fiction, it tends to be one or the other. Harold Robbins, commercial fiction, a maestro, succeeded in being wonderful at both plot and character. I think one of the greatest writers in the world today is Philip Roth, and his mm-hmm. characters just jump off the page. But the book I was working on, I have to beef up the plot. It's pretty good on character, I have to say, but you know, the reader will get the gist of the character by page 10, by page 20 maybe. But then there's got to be a bit more meat to the character mm-hmm. to make it an incredible read. But your question is great.
Yeah, and I don't know if there's an actual correct answer in this. And I think that's what everybody wants to know is, well, what's the answer? What's the answer? And I think that the answer always is, regardless of plot or regardless of character, you have to tell a good story. And you have to keep the reader engaged. And whatever you decide to do, make it concise, make it accurate, and make it entertaining. And I think that those are the three elements that authors have to realize and kind of maybe get off of the plot versus character thing. So I'm always the one that's in the middle. I'm like, I'm not on either side. Because when I read books, I just want to read great, you know, I just want to read great writing. I want to be entertained. And I just want to make sure that things are in there accurate and and the guy doesn't make a teenager girl 12 years old having a baby when that's not what he was planning on doing.
I agree. You're 100% correct. There are those writers who write for the pleasure of writing for themselves, and those writers who write for the reader. And the reader requires those very criteria that you've just outlined. Readability, mm-hmm. enjoyability. Enjoyability, is there such a word? And a good
it's a,
read.
It's a word now. We'll make it a word now.
Okay. And thank you. And a good read. And accuracy, mm-hmm. where facts are stated. Because if something is written on page 93, paragraph 2, which is blatantly wrong, that will so disturb the reader that will affect what he is able to read and enjoy from page 94 to the end. It'll stick in his mind. So I think accuracy is very important.
And since you kind of mentioned, you know, Hero in Three Continents was a book that you wrote back in 2011. And so you've kind of been here in the game now going on 4 years in the publishing game. And probably the changes that you see in the last 4 years have just been astonishing. So how do you kind of handle it day by day when you're going on, whether you're promoting or whether you're writing, because social media now is such a big thing that you can see instantaneously what your fans are thinking of your book, where, of course, 20-some years ago you would never be able to see that because there was no social media and you had to wait for the reviews to come out and what people are doing. So do you let any of these kinds of instantaneous things influence your writing into the future?
To tell you the truth, no. I think that one has to stay true to oneself, true to one's style, true to what one wants to write. And if your audience likes it, great. If they don't, you have to have the integrity of sticking to your guns. Of course, you want to sell books, but don't be all things to all men, because you just can't be. It's impossible. You have to hope that the quality of your writing, the quality of your characters and your plot will attract your audience. But no way can you be all things to all men. And that applies to art, to music. You got to stick to your to what you are. I think very, very relevant. And of course, you know, with Facebook and Twitter, it is a phenomena which didn't exist 20 years ago. I don't know how long Facebook and Twitter have been going. It might not have been 10 years ago. But
I don't think it's been 10 years.
No, I don't think so. Twitter, I think, is very new. So, mm-hmm. You know, those are great marketing tools. Use them. I say, I would advise everybody to use them, but don't compromise your talent and skills and integrity just to fit the bill.
Yeah, make sure you use those things wisely.
Yeah,
you see a lot of people that put their foot in their mouth after they hit that send button, and you can't get it back once you hit send.
I know that's true. That's very true. I think the danger also is that when one is writing, you can spend so much time online on things like Facebook and Twitter, and even research. You know, I could be researching the Acropolis in Greece, and I put in Google Acropolis, and I get the name of a restaurant, and then I look on the restaurant because it's not far from where I live. Then I see that they have a specialty of the house maybe is whatever it is, moussaka. And then I look at the recipe. And before you can turn around, you spend an hour and a half on totally irrelevant stuff. So you've got to be
right.
Very disciplined with your time.
Right.
And that's hard.
That's definitely. I mean, that's always one thing that whenever I talk to authors, you know, you kind of always hear different sides and different stories. And the one thing that you know, Now that you're writing and now that you're kind of four books in, and, you know, you probably have some advice from other authors that you had met before you were writing and things like that. What was one of those things that you kind of take forward with you as you keep continuing on through this journey in writing?
Never assume that the printout of your first draft is going to be the final version. You have to write and revise, and when you've got it into a shape that looks presentable, give it to someone you trust, an outside editor, who will give you objective advice, because 9 times out of 10, your first draft is going to be too long. You're going to put in whole chunks of material and unnecessary characters and unnecessary subplots, which will slow the book down and make it less readable and enjoyable. When that person, that editor or whoever it is, says cut pages 47 to 53 because it's boring and it slows down the plot and doesn't add anything to the book, your first reaction is ridiculous. I spent days doing that. Think
right.
about that advice for 48 hours, because 9 times out of 10, it's the right advice.
Well, Stephen, I'll tell you what, we got about 30 to 45 seconds left here. So what I want to do is I want to give you the chance to let people know, you know, where they can find you or contact you and anything else that you know, that we might have not been able to speak with. You know, take the last 30 and 45 seconds kind of on your own to kind of give all the fans that kind of information.
Well, thank you. Well, my website is maitland-lewis.com. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. And the books are available from your local bookseller, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. And I hope you enjoy my books, and I'm always delighted to hear from anyone. And they can be contacted either, as I said, Twitter, Facebook, or via my website. And happy reading, and I hope all your listeners have a lot of fun, not only with my books, but with everybody's books. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Stephen, so much. We want to thank you so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure. And, hey, you know what? We hopefully will speak with you soon, and maybe we won't cross each other. So I'll be out in California. Maybe you'll still be out there, or maybe you'll come back. Who knows? But we'll see how that dynamic kind of works.
Terrific. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
All right. Bye-bye. So, again, everybody, that is author Stephen Maitland Lewis. Again, maitland-lewis.com for more information. The book, Botticelli's Bastard, a fascinating historical read here that we're talking about. Something you definitely want to check out, go to Amazon.com. You can pick up the Kindle book. It's available, bam, right now. So we're going to take a short break. We are going to be back here with our next author, Jeff Ayers. The one thing that we do want to recommend, too, is brash-books.com is a new website that came out from Lee Goldberg, an author that you probably are familiar with. Check out what he's doing with his publishing, brash-books.com. I think you're going to really like the stuff that he's doing. So in the meantime, here we go, everybody. We'll see you in a second. Hold on. We'll be right back. to the show. Again, here we are on the second segment. We want to thank Stephen Maitland Lewis for joining us, but we are going to go in here to our next author. He is author Jeff Ayers, but you know what? Jeff does a lot more than just being an author. We've known Jeff for a couple of years. We've met him at Thriller Fest. We've talked with him many times. He's a book reviewer. He does a lot of things here with the ITW. He's involved kind of in the publishing thing, that we do and everything that we know. So it's great to have someone else here on the business side and the author side that sees both things kind of the same way that we do. And to see this crazy stuff that's changing every freaking day, it seems like, with publishing and books. So, Jeff, hey, how you doing? Thanks so much for coming on.
Oh, thanks for having me. And you're right. I think it just changed while we were on the phone.
It did. I think I just got an email that said publishing changed last night. And so, and that's the way it's been. I mean, we talk all the time. We go to these conventions. We see each other. We sit there and we talk. And we're like, yeah, the stuff we talked about last year, marketing is different now. Now it's something new this year. Or the publishers are doing something different. And I mean, our head spins. I know that your head's got to spin because you review books. You know, you involve with ITW. You see how the publishing goes. You know many different authors. And, you know, I guess the thing is, like, what do you think of everything going on? I always say that it's a great time for readers and a bad time for authors because I think that the supply has outlasted the demand in some respects. But readers have so many options to go to. But again, they still only have so much money to buy. So that's always a difficult thing.
I completely agree with you on that. There's so many choices out there, but at the same time, because there's so many choices, you got to kind of filter. And unfortunately, the reviews, the sources for reviews are shrinking. And well, as you know, that's why one of the reasons why you started Suspense Magazine, reviews are more important now than ever.
Right, it's like that's all they got.
Yeah, especially with so many choices you have.
Yeah, I mean, we were on a panel at Thriller Fest talking about, you know, where's my Oprah book review? It got a little off topic on some of the stuff, but, I mean, it was all the basic kinds of same things, you know, re-review, you review. We had a couple other people on there that, of course, do a lot of book reviews. And the one thing that I always, and people always ask is, they say, oh, you guys review, you know, how much you guys pay your reviewers? And I always say, we don't pay our reviewers. And they're like, what? How can you not do that? And the one thing, and the answer I always give is because I say, because you know what? I want a real review. And I've also always felt that if you paid somebody for one, they feel obligated to get as many done as they can to get money. But do you really get an honest review?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
Well, some of the places I review do pay and some don't.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I...
People can take you because you're honest. See, you're an honest man and you're an honest reviewer and you honestly love it. And that's why we love hearing your reviews because you're honest with them.
If I wasn't being honest, I'd stop doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that I hope is if I really am passionate about a book, that someone will see my review wherever it is and say, hey, I need to pick this book up. And as we mentioned earlier, with the filtering and stuff, the really good books, I truly hope, get noticed. And I see that happening still all the time.
And where are some of the places you review that people can find out very easily, you know, some of the places that they can see your reviews in?
I review for Library Journal, Booklist, The Associated Press, and Romantic Times, or RT Book Reviews is what they call themselves now. And I also am the book reviewer for a website called Author Magazine. And I also do interviews like this on that site.
Mm-hmm.
And it's weird being on this side of the mic, by the way.
Is it?
Yeah. And one of the things I get asked more than one of the things I get asked all the time is, well, since you reviewed it for Library Journal, we'd love to have you review this for Associated Press as well. And I cannot do that. That's the one thing, because I'm only allowed to review for one place. So my book pile is huge, and I'm always reviewing. But I love it. I get to read such great things and some bad stuff.
Hey, you know that if you ever want to send reviews to us, Davey, we'll take them. If you're ever allowed,
I know we're going to be talking after our interview. Yeah.
Yeah. If you're ever allowed to do that, you just let me know. And the one thing that you know that you're going to do, because you had mentioned that you're going to interview Robert Dugani. We talked at Thrill
Yes.
Fest, and we're
Yeah.
going to have that in the magazine. And I think that that's important. I think that a lot more people have to understand that the interviews, the things that we see with the authors out there, it's so difficult for them to get interviewed by places where there's people that congregate that, you know, they're all clamoring for that.
Hmm. Well, that leads me to a story for you. I was reviewing for Library Journal for about 3 years, and I reviewed a book for them, and I absolutely loved the book. And my editor actually called me, and she goes, "This book is terrible. What are you doing?" And I said, "I love the book. It's going to be huge." And she said, "Your reputation's on the line for this review." And I said, "Trust me, it's going to be huge." That book was The Da Vinci Code. and my editor still remembers me for that to this day. But uh-huh. as a result of that review, the local newspaper here at the time, which is now defunct, newspapers are disappearing left and right, as you know, I actually approached them about interviewing the author, Dan Brown, and mm-hmm. I convinced them to do it. And I had never interviewed an author before. And, you know, like, Dan Brown, good grief. And so I got the assignment, great, I'm so excited. And then I realized, wait a minute, I haven't even asked Dan Brown if I could do it.
Right.
So then I did all the various channels and stuff and was able to actually do the interview, and that was my very first published interview. And that sort of launched me on what I'm doing today. And in fact, it was Dan who gave me the advice.
Now, were you able to talk to him on the phone? Because I've tried several times to get a hold of him, and I don't know if it's because of the enormity of his writing now, but he's only doing, like, big shows. He's not doing
right.
any small stuff anymore. And, you know, and I tell you what, that really freaking pisses me off. Because the reason is because if it wasn't for interviews like you, and if it wasn't for interviews at the beginning when he was doing this, he would never be able to do the status that he was at. And the other thing, CNN and those places don't sell books. People that watch CNN, they think that they do. The Today Show, they don't sell books. Suspense Magazine sells books. Library right. Journal sells books. New York Review sells books. That's where people are going to buy freaking books. They're not watching CNN and going, "Oh, my God, I got to get it and do it on their Kindle right away." That's a huge misnomer. In fact, there's one major author, almost no one New York Times bestseller. Not going to mention the name but in his contract he says, do not put an ad in the New York Times because it does nothing. So he has specifically put that in his contract to stop wasting money. Because it does nothing mm-hmm. for his sales, and I think that's important. But how the hell were you able to get a hold of him? Well, first of all, because he wasn't probably as huge as he is now. But
that's exactly right. He was a struggling author, just like the majority of us, and he was more than willing to do it.
Yeah, and I've tried. Dan Brown and Grisham are the two elusives that I've never been able to get a hold of yet, and I really hate it. And I think that it's sad to see that they all had to start out where all these authors are starting out, but then all of a sudden it's like they forget it. And it's like, you know what? Give some back to the places that helped you at the beginning when nobody wanted to talk to you because you had crappy books, Digital Underground or Terminal Velocity, whatever crap he wrote. Nobody read it. But now he writes something controversial and people read it, and now all of a sudden it's like, oh, can't talk to you now. Because I wanted to talk to him about Inferno, which, first of all, I couldn't understand. I thought it was terrible. But I mean,
I thought it was better than Lost Symbol.
Lost Symbol was horrid too. I mean, and I think he lost his way. And I'm not ripping on the guy. I mean, it's fine. I understand, mm-hmm. you know, that you have to get your sources. But when you steal a book called Holy Blood, Holy Grail to make out your book, Da Vinci Code, and you don't give them the credit, and then you try to lie about it, and then you throw your wife under the bus and everything else, it's kind of like now all of a sudden you really didn't have anything to go off of. And it's kind of like maybe, you know, Digital Underground, or I forget his other books, maybe that is who you are, and maybe Da Vinci Code isn't who you are. I don't know. But I think it was a great book. Loved Angels and Demons and loved that whole topic. I thought that was fabulous. Now he got outside of it, and it seemed to be different.
Well, somebody said to me they wouldn't want to be Dan Brown because you have a book that does so well that there's only the only way you can go at this point is down.
Yep.
And, you know, in an industry where you have to do better than the previous book again and again, he's hit the absolute peak of his career 11 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, but it's a hell of a good peak to hit.
Yeah, true. Yeah, he sold more books than everybody else combined, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it did give him probably that, you know, I would probably venture to say at least 50-some million dollar deal going forward with his next couple books, maybe more than that, who knows. So, I mean, it got him the deal if that's what he wanted to do.
Well, and is the publisher making the money back is the question. Is he selling enough to make $50 million? I doubt it. I don't know. I don't have access to numbers, but I would think no one could do that.
It would be difficult. But here's the other thing, though.
I'd like to do it.
I'd like to try it. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
Here's how do you handle it? So, you know, you have a lot of authors that are friends of yours. And, you know, they give you books and they want you to review them. How do you handle it when you read it and you're like, oh, shit, this is not very good. What am I going to say?
One of the very first things I tell them right away is, if I don't like it, I'm going to be honest. But I'm not going to call you a hack or anything else. I'm going to tell you why I didn't like it. And, of course, it's just my opinion. But this is why I didn't like it. And I'm going to tell you, you know, it doesn't work or because this plot had a major hole in it. And they know I'm going to be honest. And a couple authors still, whenever I see them, they'll go, hey, you didn't like my last book. Like, yeah, I know, and here's why I didn't like it. In fact, at Thriller Fest, not this last one, but the year earlier, I was at a party. You know, they have these banquet parties after the award ceremonies and stuff.
Right.
And an author came up to me, and he was drunk, but he just started ripping me apart. He goes, how dare you hate my book? And he just went off on me. And so I just reiterated why I didn't like the book, which I'd said in my review. And I finally said to him, I said, you know, I think the problem is you realize I'm right. And that ended the discussion.
Ooh, nice. See,
I don't know where that came from.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. And I think that some authors have to realize, too, that you're going to have negativity and you're going to have positivity. But if you only focus on the negative part, you're never going to move yourself forward. You're just not.
Right.
I mean,
And I always try to focus on positive as well. Like, this is what really works about this book. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And now the one thing that we don't do in the magazine is we never write a negative review. We always say if you can't find something positive to say about it, because every book has an audience. I don't care what you're writing about. I don't care if you're writing about, you know, dolls on Mars. There's going to be a person who's, you know, going to find that interesting. So my policy, dolls on Mars. Because my policy and Shannon's policy has always been find something positive. But if you cannot find anything and it's just that bad, then we just simply say, you know what, we just can't review it because there's just nothing. There's nothing there for us. So we try to do, you know, we try to take that approach. Where you know, something that's just a, you know, probably a little bit different than what is done. But I know that it's difficult. And then when you wrote your book, Long Overdue, you had to have seen a little of the flip side of some of the reviews that happened. Now, your book came out in 2013, again, Long Overdue. It's available on Kindle, and it's $3.99 right now because I'm looking at it. So people can go get the freaking thing. Now, what did you do when you had somebody that wrote something that was negative? How did you handle it on that side? Because now you're on the other side.
Yeah, part of me wanted to email that person and say, hey, look, this is what I was trying to do. And then I realized, you know, I am on the other side here, and it's true. You could write the absolute best book you can, which is what I did at the time, and I feel like the one I'm working on now is even better. But you're not going to please everybody, and that's okay. And you have to sort of – being in this business, you got to take the blows with the praise, and that's okay. And I'm sorry – the people that didn't like it, I'm sorry they didn't like it. Hopefully they'll try me again with my next book, you know. And it's always about trying to do the best I can and tell the best story I can.
So now, did you take any of the negative reviews or things that you saw and use it as a motivation maybe for the next book or try to avoid some of the pitfalls that maybe they thought were in the book now working on the book that you're doing right now?
Yes, absolutely. I do look at the feedback, and I got some nice feedback from authors as well as the readers who've been posting reviews. And yes, there's been some comments about, you know, this person wouldn't have done that. Like, oh, okay, I see that now. So yes, I'm trying very hard to address what people were thinking were not the best things I had done in the first book.
Mm-hmm. And it's kind of funny, too, when you get the review, or maybe when you're giving a review, the thing that the fan focuses on, it's like, really? That's what they're focusing on? It's like all the other stuff's going on, but they're really worried about Charles the cat and if he ate the right food or something? Really? That's the right emails I'm freaking getting? Don't you find that interesting how fans...
Well, actually, I had a scene with a dog in my book, and I went out of my way to make sure the dog was safe.
Be careful. Right.
I did. I made sure I went out of my way to get the dog safe, and someone said, you know, what's the deal with the dog? Like, even making sure the dog was safe, you can't win with animals.
The dog was in a bulletproof car. It was temperature controlled. He had plenty of Alpo. He even had Animal Planet on. And you're like, really? What are you doing to the poor dog?
My villain actually saves the dog, puts it in an area where it will be safe, and says, I'm not that cruel.
You can kind of get away in books as long as you know, I mean, as long as people know that you're going to be that evil in killing children. But you have to be very, very careful how you do it. But if you kill a dog or a cat, it's over. That's a career killer.
Mm-hmm. I release nerve gas. I blow up buildings. I have SWAT getting involved and lots of bullets and death. And, people comment about the dog.
I know. I find that just totally hilarious, and I just like, really? I don't understand that part. But, I definitely get the passion for it, but maybe it's like, I don't know, maybe it's just because dogs and cats are helpless and they can't do anything or fend for them. I don't know. But then Ren 10-10, man, that thing was freaking, he was awesome. Him and Lassie, they could do things for themselves.
Yeah, if I ever fall down a well, I want to make sure Lassie's next to me.
Oh, exactly, because he's definitely going to tell people where, you know, where things are.
Exactly.
So
Here's
the other thing. Let's talk about conventions, because we're in New Orleans, and we were supposed to go to Heather Graham's writing conference, something that's, you know, really, really cool. We've never been. She asked us to come, so we were coming, and then it got postponed, but we decided to come here anyway. But, you know, you have the Pacific North Writers Convention, one that we really want to get to next year.
It's our 60th anniversary. You're coming. I'll make it happen.
Right.
We're
going to go. Shay and I already decided that that's one of the ones we're going to go. But then you have Killer Nashville. Then you have Thriller Fest. Then you have VoucherCon. Then you have, you know, Malice and all these other ones around.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think writing conferences are good for authors and sales, or are they better for fans just to kind of see that authors really are normal people who like to talk bad about their publishers and their contracts, and they like to drink?
I have to say it's neither. I think it's fantastic for networking. I think if you're an author, you do have a captive audience, and you will sell some books, but not as many as you'd like.
I agree with that. Yeah.
I think that if you're a beginning writer, it's a great opportunity to learn the craft from the people who are successful at it, and it's also a great way to meet people who can help you get into the business. But to me, it's the networking. It's all about who you're meeting, who you're helping, and just being at the right place at the right time. And if it wasn't for these conferences I've gone to, I wouldn't be where I am today. I wouldn't have my book published. I wouldn't have gotten my first agent. I wouldn't have been writing for the Associated Press and other places. It's all about just being in the right place at the right time.
Yeah,
and
these
conferences give you that opportunity.
Yeah, they're very, very social. I mean, that is one thing. Like, if you're a fan and you're just standing at the bar, let's just say Thriller Fest, and you go down into the Hyatt and you stand at the bar, I mean, who knows who you're standing next to? Because, well, a lot of the times the authors don't look like they do on their book covers. But
that's true.
It's just never who you're standing to. I mean, and you're standing in a room where billions of books have been sold by these guys. I mean, Steve Barry, David Morrell, Lee Child. I mean, all these great authors are standing there next to you. And you have one of the greatest minds of writing in just kind of one place. But it is kind of funny that you just don't seem to sell a lot of books, which is, I think, is what a lot of these young authors think that they're going to do. Like, they're going to go and get on a panel, and they're going to sit with Doug Lyle talking about medicine, and you're going to sell books. And it's like, yeah, no, you're not. I'm sorry, but that's not what it's for.
What you're doing is you're making yourself visible. And by making yourself visible over time, sort of thing, but I wouldn't expect it immediately. And, you know,
and
this year I had a book to sell, and I sold maybe 4 or 5. But, I mean, I was running around Thriller Fest the whole weekend having a blast.
Were.
And, yeah. And one of the fun things in addition to our panel is I got to moderate one, and that was amazing. I love moderating panels for them.
I've never moderated one yet. They've never asked me to do that. Of course I would if they asked me to. Who knows where they would put me. But I think that would be fun to kind of moderate. But the other thing is that people like you, people like me, other people of the press, we get a lot of people talking to us because we're the ones that basically can take them from the room that we're in to the outside world. And I think that that's important. Now, the one thing that I do think that I want to bring up with the ITW, I do think that they would sell more books from these authors, is if they could take this event and they could stream it live on the Internet and have it in demand. So even if you can't be there and you want to see a panel or you want to hear the author talk, you want to do something, stream it, video it, put it out there. Let people pay $29.99 for the full effect, and they can sit there and watch these panels and hear these authors and see these things. I think that those fans would find that so interesting and say, wow, these guys really are freaking interesting and funny and engaging, that I wish that they would do that because a lot of people can't afford to go to Thriller Fest and spend $1,000 on the tickets and the flights and the hotels. But you know what? Maybe they can spend $49.99 to see the whole thing on their computer, and they can see it whenever they want to.
That's a fantastic idea. I think they would generate a lot of interest for sure. A couple of years ago, HarperCollins asked me to moderate a live stream event at Thriller Fest, and it was me interviewing Jim Rollins and Diana Gabaldon.
Oh, nice.
And that was a lot of fun. They told me, oh, just prepare 5 questions, and since it's live, people will be able to feed in questions. And while I was doing the interview, I got through my 5 questions, and I kind of look over at the monitor, and I keep seeing the words, I've got nothing. And so I had to wing it, and I cannot to this day tell you, without going back and watching the interview itself, what I said and what they said. I was so petrified. But you can't
really
tell, thank goodness. Yeah. And both of them afterwards said, man, that was pretty good. You prepared a lot of questions. Like, yeah, I did.
You're like, yeah, I just prepared them in the last 30 seconds. But that's the thing, because when we're interviewing and just from talking or whatever, they'll say something that will spur a question, and that's the good thing. Like, the authors will say something that will make you think of, like, oh, okay, let's hit this a little further. Because when I interview authors, just like the last author I just had, Stephen Maitland-Lewis, I don't really – people say, give me the questions ahead of time. I'm like, yeah, you're not going to get any because I have one, and that is tell me about your book. That's the first question. After that, I just start going off of what you have said. I go off of your site. I go after your thing like that. That's what I go after. So it's like, I don't have all these questions that you're going to get from me. I just don't do it that way because I find it too scripted if I'm sitting there saying, okay, and question number 2, tell me. I know I don't like to do that. I like to just make it an engaging, fun, entertaining conversation. That's it.
Well,
that's
and
what we've
the
had
truth
here.
Is, I listen to your interviews and I podcast them and listen to them on my drive into work. And I love them and I love the format you do. And so, thank you for letting me be on again. I do appreciate that.
Oh,
and
yeah,
one of the
I think
things I should. One of the things I do at Thriller Fest is I help record the sessions and their audio. So
I know.
You mentioned
I got
doing
them
the, yeah, I, there's so
what
much
you're
fun
gonna
to listen
hear,
to.
What you're going to hear on the radio show is I got them all. I got the okay from Patrick. I'm going to take 5 and 10 minute clips out of them, and I'm playing them here on the show so people can hear what they're missing and then go buy the CD.
That's fantastic.
He allowed me to do that for all of it. So it's going to take a little time because there's a lot of information, and I have to take them and snip them. And so I'm going to do all the Craft Fest. I have all the Craft Fest ones. I have the Thriller Fest ones that I can take, and I can snip them and put them out, like I said, five to 10 minute clips because they go on for almost an hour, and then people can hear what they're missing, and then they can go out and they can go buy the CD. Because
half
there's
of my
so
iPod
much information
is...
in Craft Fest.
Half of my iPod's loaded with those interviews and the Craft Fest, Thriller Fest stuff. And the information they give you is priceless. It really is. That's exciting.
Well,
I look forward to hearing what you do.
Well, I'll tell you what, Jeff. We've killed this half hour. We could have kept going for another half hour easily. But I want to thank you so much for coming on. I'll tell you what. Anytime you want to come on with me, if you see a guest or anything and you want a guest host, man, just email me. We'll do it together.
I would love that.
We can get those together. I mean, I'd love having that stuff on because, you know, sometimes I just hear myself talk and I'm like, God, my voice sounds so crappy. So it's like someone else can, you know, have some different stuff going on too. So,
well, thank you. It's
and
wonderful.
I'm waiting to see the Robert Dugani interview that's going in the magazine soon. So that's going to be good too.
You'll get it soon, I promise.
All right. Well, everybody, I want to thank Jeff so much for coming on. We're going to take a short break. And, Jeff, we will see you soon.
Sounds great. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. So, again, everybody, we're going to take a short break here. We're going to be back with our next guest on the show. You know him, Doug Lyle, not only author extraordinaire with everything forensics, everything with his new book, Original Sin, but, of course, one of the co-hosts of Crime and Science Radio. So he's going to be on next, so stay tuned. Homecoming song. back, everybody, here to the end of the break. We want to make sure that we had welcomed Stephen Maitland-Lewis for being on earlier, and then we just had Jeff Ayers on. We are switching gears. We are coming up here with author D.P. Lyle. You know him, of course, from his great book, Samantha Cody series, Dub Walker series. He now, of course, is the co-host of Crime and Science Radio, which can be heard here on Suspense Radio. And, of course, everything forensics that he has written. His latest book is called Original Sin, and we want to welcome Doug to the show. So, Doug, thanks so much for coming on the other side of the microphone and letting us interview you.
Thanks for having me here, John.
So Original Sin here is your latest book. It's got some wonderful reviews. I know that, you know, we reviewed it very highly. Shannon just loved it. She thought it was one of your best works to date. So why don't you give us a little bit about that inside information into your latest book here?
Well, it's called Original Sin. It's the third in my Samantha Cody series. And I wrote two Sam books about a dozen years ago, Devil's Playground and Double Blind. And then they both were out of print. And so this story kind of came into my head, and I said, this is the perfect Samantha book. So I resurrected her, and now this is the third in the series. So we've published them as an E and POD book, and we've brought back the first two. So it's kind of like a trilogy that we're putting out there. In this story, Sam always gets into trouble. So she's a cop from a small town in the Mojave complex out in the California high desert, and people who are familiar with that, is close to Route 66, the old Route 66, a little town called Mercer's Corner that I made up. Anyway, she lost her job as a cop, and because she was supposed to be the next police chief, but then shenanigans, so she's traveling around, and she ends up in Remington, Tennessee, visiting a friend of hers, a cardiovascular surgeon named Lucy Wagner, and Dr. Wagner is the premier cardiovascular surgeon in this small town, but her patients start doing bizarre things. They start doing horrible crimes after surgery, and Lucy starts having fainting spells and weird dreams. And anyway, Sam gets involved in solving this whole issue, and basically it goes back to Lucy's birth and childhood and early family history and all kinds of intrigue, and of course there's a whole cadre of snake-handling preachers involved.
And that's the thing that I found interesting when you talked about that at Thriller Fest, was you were talking about the snake-handling preachers, because, I mean, there's crazy, and then there's that. And
yeah.
You said that you kind of had to get involved research-wise into that area. So you got to tell us about what you kind of found out, because, you know, of course, you see them depicted on TV and this and that, but I think that that's so much different than probably the way it is in real life.
Sure. I mean, and I grew up with knowing about these people because they weren't far from where I grew up in Huntsville, Alabama, which is a moderate-sized southern town with a church on every corner and pickup trucks. But, oh, yeah, by the way, there's a space program in the backyard. So I went to school with kids from really all over the world, and because of the space program, they attracted a lot of people there. So Huntsville was an unusual city. But you get 30 miles away, you know, and you're in the foothills of the Appalachians, and you're in places like Scottsboro and Albertville and Boaz and on up into, you know, Tennessee and North Carolina and West Virginia and the Appalachian chain. Well, there are a lot of snake-handling churches there. They're basically Pentecostal Christians, and they use a passage from Mark that says that, you know, they will take up the serpent and no poison will harm them and da-da-da-da-da. And they do handle snakes as part of their religious worshiping. And they also speak in tongues and sing and dance and do all this stuff. Well, it's interesting because I was talking to my dad about this, and he said, oh, yeah. He said, we used to go to those things all the time. Now, my dad grew up in Tupelo, Mississippi, and during the Depression on a farm. But he said that he and his mother, they used to take her over to, and his sisters would take them over to, they called them holy rollers then. It was basically for entertainment. And they'd go stand in the back of the church and kind of watch all this spectacle go on before them, and sometimes the snakes would come out, you know. Well, once a snake got loose, and he said he was probably about 5 years old, and his mother handed him out the window to this other guy who was standing outside, and then she climbed out the window, and they got out of there. They never went back. So Dad even experienced this back in the 30s. Actually, back in the 20s, the early 20s. Dad's 95 now. So then I started researching, and I found out there's actually over 200 of these churches, and they're really scattered all over the country. Obviously, most are along the Appalachian chain, but they're all over. There's videos online. All you got to do is Google snake handling preachers, and you'll be it'll be interesting what you find out. A lot of videos of these guys.
It's a very kind of taboo-ish, religious organization. They're very, very, very strict biblical people, that they do. But then they take this aspect of the serpent and the snake. And, and how many of them are dying and get bit from, from their craft, I guess. You see that all the time.
Yeah, there was a guy that died just a few months ago from a snake bite. See, they don't go to doctors after they get bit by a snake. And, they maybe sip a little strychnine. They think that'll help. And they just let the Lord take care of it. And sometimes he does, and sometimes he doesn't. People are pretty tough, so they survive a lot of things, including snake bites. But it's always best to go see the doctor and get the antivenom and stuff like that. So there's a guy named Punkin Brown that died, and actually in the book, there's a guy, a fictional character up in West Virginia that dies, and he's an important part of the story, kind of in the backstory, and he died from a snake bite and things like that. It's not uncommon. You handle rattlesnakes, you're going to get bit.
Now, the one thing, and I'm going to preference this with like a musician with what you've done as an author, because as an author, like you said, it took you 12 years, and now you come out with your next Samantha Cody book. And if you're a musician that hasn't played a certain song for 12 years, and then all of a sudden you're going back to kind of figure it out. You kind of heard this. I don't know if you ever heard the story of, Eddie Van Halen when he was going to go back out. He actually literally had to go back and re-listen to an album because he forgot how to play some songs when he was going to go on concert. So what did you have to do in preparation of 12 years removed from Samantha Cody to get yourself back now into writing Original Sin to where she was the character that you're going to bring her back out again?
Actually, it wasn't that hard because, during writing those first two books, I lived with Sam for about 3 years, actually even longer, because one of them was one of the first books I ever wrote, so we worked on it in group for a year or so. So I know Sam exceptionally well. So when this story cropped up in my head and I decided this is the perfect Sam story, it just kind of took off, and it was actually pretty easy to write. It went very fast. And so I didn't really have to go back and read anything, which I don't ever do anyway because I find typos and go completely crazy. But I know Sam, so it was pretty easy to jump back into her mold.
But the one thing that people might realize or might see also is that when you wrote Double Blind and then you wrote Devil's Playground and now you're into Original Sin, your writing style probably has changed because you were with Dub Walker. So how was that kind of dynamic? Going back and you're like, wow, I didn't write like that back then, even though it's the same character. Was that kind of weird for you?
Sure. And there's no question. You're writing better progress in a dozen years. And I think mine has, like most anybody who spends time doing it. And the temptation when we're bringing these books back is to go out and re-edit them and rewrite them, so to speak, is there. But somehow that's unfair, It somehow that just seems unfair to me. The book's been out there. It was out of print, so it wasn't available or only partially available through, used books. And to go back and change it now seemed cheating to me. I was proud of those books when I wrote them. Could I write them better now? Of course. But they're still great stories. I think they're fun reads. And I think you leave things alone. You can't go back and revise history.
Did you add any certain special kind of forewords or prologues or anything within the books for any updates? Or are they totally as is?
No, they're totally as is.
But I do like the new cover designs. The new cover designs now are all. So they're all, they're all very conformatory to the three of them. So you can definitely tell it's Samantha Walker or Samantha Cody. I think that's great.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons we did that. And the only repackaging, so to speak, that was done was cleaning up typos and things like that we found again later. And, a couple of things that didn't make sense, but they were like one sentence changes and stuff, dropping a paragraph, and that was about it as far as editorial. And those were basically for content, for clarity rather than changing the content. And then we did new covers to kind of brand them all as one series.
Mm-hmm. And so in the book Original Sin, and again, we are speaking here with author D.P. Lyle. If you want to find out more information, go to dplylemd.com for a lot more information, of course, especially on Original Sin, the whole Samantha Cody series and the Dub Walker series. You can find out more information there, too. So besides Samantha and Lucy, which kind of character in the book Original Sin surprised you with maybe having a bigger voice than you maybe had originally thought when you were conceptualizing the book and you started getting it down?
Well, I'm not sure they had a bigger voice, but that they had a very they were fun characters. One of there's a love interest, so to speak, who is a deputy sheriff there named Ty, and he and Sam kind of have an unfulfilled relationship, but they have a relationship nonetheless. And he's got an ex-wife who is completely insane. And so she shows up, and I mean, there's even one scene where Sam finds herself, and Sam doesn't hide from anybody, finds herself hiding in a card shop so she won't run into this woman because this woman is completely has no brakes. Then there's two brothers that work for the preacher guy and the snake handling preacher guy, and they become sinister forces that Sam has to deal with, and in some very unusual ways. So there's a lot of characters. You know, these characters pop up as you're writing, and they
do, don't they?
And some of them blossom and become really cool characters. Some of them are just kind of, you know, placeholders. But these characters, some of these really popped out, and it's like, wow, I love these guys. I'd like to write a story about them.
And the other thing that's got to be difficult, of course, for you is, I mean, you're such an intelligent medical forensic mind, I mean, that you have in your brain. I mean, you know, you've probably forgotten more things than a lot of people are ever going to even know in their lifetime about the field. So when you have to sit here and write these books and you kind of have to dumb it down for people like me who don't understand all that kind of terminology, is it difficult in times when you're like, I really want to say this, but I can't because even though it's factually right, I have to change it because otherwise people just might not get it.
Well, there's always that battle going on is how much is too much and how much is not enough. And I've always kind of sided toward doing less than more. You throw in a couple of technical terms, but you let the context kind of give the reader, if they're not medically minded, they understand the concept of what's going on, even though they may not have the background to understand all the details. But they understand the concept. And those things you have to wrestle with is how do you word this? Where do you put this? Order of information? When do you tell them this, et cetera? And also to make it accurate so that those people who do have a medical bent or have that kind of knowledge, they say, oh, yeah, that's real, that's factual. But I think the key, and I run into this a lot when I work with other writers, if you're writing something about some cool technical thing, just remember the story's not about the cool technical thing. The story's about the characters. The cool technical thing is just there to put stress on the characters, or it's the background, it's the milieu under which all this is happening, and that's kind of how this is. You know, you don't need to know how to analyze DNA to know that DNA is important and that it can identify people. So you don't have to get into the weeds, but you do have to understand the concept.
And the other thing is that you do read books and you review them. I mean, you review for people. You know, you'll give your blurbs and your things like that. Does it make you crazy because, you know, if they're writing in kind of a subject that you're familiar with, that they go ahead and they write something, you're like, oh, my God, please don't say it like that because that's so, like, not true?
No, I don't know if I've really run across
you
that
let it
myself.
Pass?
But, you know, I do. Sometimes people need guidance. Let's put it that way, and they need to be led down a path where. And occasionally, people will come up with an idea, and I'll say, "No, there's just no way this is going to work." But remember, you can stretch truth a little bit, so why don't we think about doing this? If you just change this and this, then it makes sense. But if you leave it like this, you know, it makes me squirm a little. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, they say, that's great, thanks, you know, and every now and then somebody doesn't want to change. But, you know, they will eventually because an editor will come along and say, this doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah. And that's the kind of the point that I want to get across to the listeners, everybody who's listening, is that when you're reading a book by you and they're able to see those kinds of things in there that are written, they do know that you have taken, you know, the time to make sure that it is factually correct, even in a fictional sense, and therefore lays that much more, you know, expansion to the story and the characters. And
oh,
that's
sure.
a hard thing to do.
Yeah. Yeah. And that does take work, you know, and I read all the time. So I often run across stories where the science or the medicine or something is totally wrong. And in fact, it's sometimes frighteningly wrong because mm-hmm. people have an understanding of what they think science and medicine's all about because they've been on the internet and looked up some stuff, but they don't have a background with which to filter the, you know, the wheat from the chaff. And they come up making some stupid mistakes. But, you know, once it's published, it's too late. And number two, those things are easy. All you got to do is ask questions. You know, people love to talk about what they know, so find an expert in whatever you're looking for. I don't care what it is. And as a writer, and just contact them. Go on the internet, look at who's writing the scientific article. Send them a note. You'll be amazed at the college professors who will write you back and say, oh, I'd love to tell you. What do you need to know? You know, and then, you know, ask them the questions you need to ask, and they will help you. And then you can get it right. Not only that, when you find out what the truth is, it may open up whole new story ideas that you hadn't thought of. So
true.
I think it's important to ask questions.
And the other, and so now that book 3 of Samantha Cody here, and just so readers have an idea, you know, before they pick up the book Original Sin here, since it's 12 years difference, how did you kind of handle that time frame of being off with her after Devil's Playground and now into Original Sin? How did you die? How did you age it?
I ignored it. As far as Sam's concerned, this is just next month, you know. It's and if you read the series, that's pretty much how it is. She ends up losing her job. Well, you don't know that at the end of Double Blind, but basically you know that there's conflict between her and the city council. And so she ends up losing her job, which you find out in Original Sin. And so she's just out traveling the country, and one of the stops she's making, because she's never really seen the country, one of the stops she's making is to see her friend Lucy. And then as soon as she comes the day she arrives, all this starts starting. It started right before she got there when Lucy fainted in surgery, which she never does. She's rock solid. And then the whole story starts from there. And, of course, Sam is going to be involved if there's a story like that. She's not going to sit on the sidelines.
So the one thing is that people can read the books out of order. They can pick Original Sin up now, then they can go back to Double Blind and then to Devil's Playground and not really miss, because like you said, you can, you know, you did kind of ignore all of that. So the thing is that I guess would you suggest that maybe they do read in order? Do they not read in order? How would you kind of suggest them to do it?
It doesn't matter. I mean, it's kind of like reading Michael Connelly's Harry Bosch or Lee Child's Jack Reacher. You can actually join that series in any of the books. And because each book and each story, even though readers who are familiar with those characters, who have read, you know, all the Connelly and the Child books, they may get little nuances that a reader who's new to the thing in the 20th book, you know, won't get. But those don't really change the story. Each story is a story within itself. It has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and it stands alone. So you can read them in any order you want.
So let's get a little into Crime and Science Radio.
Because
you host the show here on Suspense Radio, and it's been going on now, I mean, for, boy, what are we, over a year, I think.
Yeah, amazing.
How much fun are you having?
Oh, a lot. I mean, as you know, I mean, Jan and I love working with you on this thing, and we appreciate you. You're giving us a platform to babble, but Jan Burke and I have wanted.
Are you kidding me? I find it so fascinating with the guests and you guys. God.
Well, Jan and I have babbled together for years, you know, at different panels and different talks we've given to writers' groups and stuff. But we've always wanted to do radio, and we've talked about it for years. So finally, as you know, a year ago, we went to dinner and sat down and said, okay, it's time to light the candle on this puppy. Let's either do it or not. And we decided we wanted to, and that's when I suggested, well, you know, I bet John would like this. And so that's when I contacted you, and then we got it on Suspense Radio. And we have just had a ball with it, and we've met so many wonderful, wonderful, wonderful people because, as you know, we've had great guests on there.
It's just amazing. Yeah.
It's just amazing, the people, from Cyril Weck to, you know, Marcia Clark.
The list goes on and on.
I can't even remember all. We had Barry Fisher on there recently, who founded the L.A. Crime Lab. We've had Paul
Michael
Bishop
Tabor
on there, who was outstanding.
Oh.
Linda Fairstein. Yeah. I mean, yeah. And Alifair Burke recently. Yeah.
Yep. And then one of the thing that I always find interesting is when I'm sitting here producing the show and I'm listening to it, because, you know, we record these. I mean, we used to say, you know, try to stay there live, but we record these and then we play them live on Saturdays at 10 a.m. So that's the first time people are listening to them. But the thing that I always find interesting is when you and Jan are sitting there, it's like one of you might not know the guest. So it's like, say, if Jan knows him and you don't, you're sitting there like, this is fascinating shit. I never knew all this.
Sure.
It's like you're learning yourself, too. I love that.
Always, always. And even people that you know, I mean, you bring them on and you're talking to them about it. You know, like we had Deborah Bloom on, who wrote The Poisoner's Handbook, which I recommend everyone to read, especially if you're a crime fiction writer, and especially if you write historical crime fiction, because it's all about the birth of forensic toxicology.
Yeah.
And it's a wonderful, wonderful book. But Deborah was great. She was fantastic. And even though I read the book and I knew about her, we learned so much talking to her. It was just unbelievable. Yeah.
You know, and one of the best ones I think that I heard, which was recent, was Dr. Michael, was Michael Tabor with the forensic dentist.
Yes.
Because that is so flippin' fascinating, the stuff that they have to do. Oh.
We were just back in Nashville for Killer Nashville, and Nan and I went out for dinner with Mike and his wife, wonderful people, and he is so bright. He is the forensic dentist for the state of Tennessee, and he was at 9/11 identifying bodies and all this, and he's just an incredibly personable guy. He's actually going to teach a class for us next year at Craft Fest in New York,
fabulous,
as part of Thriller Fest. So Mike's going to come do that and talk about forensic identification. And, you know, forensic dentists deal with identification through dental records, but they also deal with bite marks. And so he's going to address both of those then. But yeah, he was wonderful. And, of course, John will probably tell you, but you can go to Crime and Science Radio, and it's on my site.
Yeah.
We have a crimeandscienceradio.com blog, and you can connect and listen to all the past shows, just like this one. You can listen to this one. You can listen to all those shows, too.
Yeah. Yeah, everything's on demand, which is what I found great. And the thing that I'm doing this year, which I don't know if you heard me talk with Jeff, is that I got a copy of every Thriller Fest and Craft Fest panel from Patrick, and I'm going to put a little 5 to 10 minute snippet here on the radio show so people can hear what they're missing and then go out and buy the CD, because you can still buy those CDs and get all that information just like if you were there. And so I'm hopefully going to spur some people on that are going to do that, because I really hope that people will buy those things. So Patrick was nice enough to say, if you want to go ahead and do it, go ahead and do it. So I want to thank him so much for that.
Oh, that's great. That's great. So, Craft Fest is special.
and you're the godfather of Craft Fest. You got to say it.
And we're going to have Jeff on the show.
Yeah, that's right.
On the radio show, he's in a couple of weeks.
So that's going to be great. Well, I'll tell you what, Doug, we want to thank you so much for coming on this side here and letting us interview you for a half hour. Love the book, Original Sin. So it's great to see you bring back Samantha Cody. I'm sure fans were
yep.
probably emailing you in hate mail, like, where the hell is she? So that was good that you were able to bring her back out.
Well, I appreciate that.
So, all right, Doug, you have a good one. We will talk with you later.
I'll see you soon. Thanks.
And we'll talk with you soon. All right, bye.
Yes, bye-bye.
So, again, everybody, that is author Doug Lyle. Go to dplylemd.com for more information on the book Original Sin, the latest in his Samantha Cody series. You're going to love it. I mean, when you get into it, you just can't help but read it in one sitting, and that's the great thing that Doug is able to do, of course. And everything he's got going on with Crime and Science Radio, you go to crimeandscienceradio.com to see all the interviews that him and Jan have done with the experts in the fields of many different types of fields, any kind of forensics, law, police procedurals. I mean, heck, the director of ESPN Security was on there, FBI stuff, so you got all those great things. So we want to thank everybody for being on here, from Stephen Maitland-Lewis to Jeff Ayers to now D.P. Lyle. And, again, this worked out well, remote location from New Orleans. It is freaking pouring outside. So I don't know what we're going to do, but we're going to think of something. Who knows? But we want to thank you all for joining us. We will see you all in a couple weeks. So until that time, everybody, enjoy yourself and have fun, and goodbye.